Will the pandemic increase the need for health care for all people long term?
Yes, sir, it will. And Stu, I appreciate you asking that question because I think where we have to start in answering that question is to say our federal response to keep it under control has been a failure. We've lost far too many Americans. Heck, we've lost far too many Kentuckians. And that's a failure. We have to fix that first. But for the healthcare portion of this question, we've now got more than 7 million infections in the United States, and that is going to be considered a pre-existing condition. So we have to make sure that we're protecting people who are now at risk of if folks in protections for people with pre-existing conditions, we have to make sure that we put a stop to that because 7 million additional on top of 100 million or so Americans that have pre-existing conditions now, it just compounds the failure. And so there's going to be plenty of healthcare related work to be done to make sure we're offering a public option, make sure that we are taking care of the cost and introducing some prescription drug price, pricing measures to make sure folks aren't spending their entire paycheck trying to stay alive. But we got to get it under control first. We've got to have a federal unified response that says we're going to put a stop to losing 1,500 to 2,000 Americans every single day.
The Horse Integrity and Safety Act, which has the emphasis on both, improper use of drugs in horse racing and track safety, will that change the thoroughbred racing industry?
I don't know if it'll change it. What I will say about it is we have to do the very best we can to protect the animals and to protect the integrity of horse racing at large. And if this bill does that, I think that will be a good thing because we certainly want to make sure that we are taking care of a signature industry that we're proud of here in Central Kentucky.
What, if anything, needs to change in policing? And what about federal police standards?
I think when we're talking about changes necessary in policing, the largest conversation has to center around state and local government control and what they can do to affect and to influence their departments. But from a federal perspective, there's a number of things we can do. We can push community-based policing standards to ensure that police officers live in and work in, shop in, play in their communities, that they become, truly a part of that community so that as a public servant there, they can see the benefit of treating everyone equally, can see the benefit of being careful in how they interact with folks. And also, the community gets to see them outside of uniform. The community gets to see them as a part of that. That's a piece of it. From the federal perspective, we can also end the militarization of police departments, right? Stop sending down tens of billions of dollars in up-armored vehicles and flak jackets because that is contrary to community policing. So we can do those two things. And the third thing I think that from a federal perspective we have to do is where you have bad actors in a police department, where you have someone that does the wrong thing, improper use of force, improper use of deadly force, and gets fired for it, we have to make sure that an unsuspecting police department down the road that might be suffering under budget cuts or otherwise from some of the austerity policies that we've seen pushed in the past, they don't end up with that bad actor at their police department unknowingly, so that we have a good database. And you can check and say, is this someone who is an upstanding public servant like we'd like our police officers to be? Or is this someone who has caused problems in the past that we should avoid? I think those are a few things we can do from a federal perspective that can help.
Outside of Lexington, Josh, how best to further the economies of the other counties in the district?
Well, we've got diverse counties all across this district, whether we're talking about Lexington or Richmond or Georgetown or Fleming County, where I'm from, or Menifee County. And so we have to do things that lift everybody up. We have to make sure that everybody's kind of brought along. And outside of Lexington in particular, I think there's a lot we can do from an infrastructure perspective, right? We have a modern economy now. And those who have jobs that they can work remotely and those who have access to broadband internet, they have been okay during this pandemic, but unfortunately, far too many people have not been okay. They have lost jobs. We've 1.5 million Kentucky unemployment claims over the last few months, and people wondering if they're ever going to be able to participate in this economy. So, two things I think we have to do from an infrastructure perspective, we have to make sure that everyone has the same opportunity from a broadband perspective, a cellular coverage perspective. We can do some things with sort of more traditional infrastructure. Mount Sterling needs another off-ramp on 64 to help their industry continue growing. And then we can do things in workforce development and education to ensure we've got a workforce that reflects who we are as Kentuckians, hardworking folks who just want to take care of our families and would be an asset to any company, to any industry. And I think if we help just enough with infrastructure, with workforce development, we're going to see that growth out just everywhere across this district.
What current agriculture issues need to be addressed more fully at the federal level?
Well, you know, I'm a kid that grew up on a farm in Fleming County, and everybody I knew, including me, grew tobacco, and it was a cash crop for everybody. It was something that supplemented income, and when that went away, that did a lot of damage for agriculture all across this district. And unfortunately, we've seen it compounded now by this trade war we're engaged in, that are costing row crop farmers across this district lots and lots of money. And I understand tens of billions of dollars has been sent out west into big states out there to giant corporate farms. But I think from a federal perspective, we have to be much more focused in a district like this on small, medium-sized farms, family farms, because I'm tired of seeing kids have to leave the family farm because they can't find the dignity of a living wage on that farm anymore. And we can't find the dignity of being able to afford just a middling lifestyle, because you're now having to work a couple of jobs on top of coming home and feeding, on top of coming home and trying to milk, on top of coming home and trying to spray or get your row crop ready. I think we just have to make sure we're careful in developing markets that don't prioritize giant corporate farms over our small and family farms that are the backbone of agriculture here in Central Kentucky.
Social Security has always been a popular topic. You don't hear as much today, but there's been fears it will go away someday. Do you think it'll be around for 10, 20, 30 years from now?
I think it depends on the outcome of the next few elections, Stu. I think that with this payroll tax holiday that the president said he wants to make permanent, Social Security will be totally at $0 by 2023. And so if that happens, we won't have Social Security anymore. And that's a tremendous burden to put on folks who are just trying to get by. That's a tremendous burden to put on folks who are just struggling and scraping as it is. And so we're either going to have policies that promote Social Security as the safety net that it is, or we're going to allow elections to put folks in power that want to see it done away with. And we're all going to suffer for it, not just the people, not just the human cost of losing that $700 a month or whatever it might be, but the economic cost of people going totally broke and having no money to spend in their local community. And it's going to further run down these local economies, especially in rural areas. So I, for one, am totally on board with protecting Social Security. I think we have to do away with this payroll tax holiday we've done that's going to bankrupt. I think we have to make sure that we protect people who need it to survive. And I think that's exactly where we need to be.
I could have asked this off the top, but I wanted to get to some issues, obviously, as well. But, Josh, why are you running?
I'm running, Stu, because there's not a whole lot of folks like me in the United States Congress. There's not a lot of folks that grew up on a farm out in Fleming County. Not a lot of folks who dropped out of college. Not a lot of folks who struggled and scraped and lived on a poverty wage for a big chunk of their life, who really struggled to get by, who bought a double-wide trailer as their first home out on Tribby Lane and Hilltop. You know, there's just not a lot of folks with that kind of perspective. And I think it's a valuable one, because I think there's a lot more folks in this district and a lot more folks across the United States with an upbringing like mine, with a background like mine, than there are folks who, you know, came all out of country clubs and came all out of elite Ivy League colleges. And I think a diversity of perspective would be very, very useful in legislating for folks who really need it, for folks who don't feel like they get the benefit of good government that cares about them.
Is there a feasible way to significantly reduce partisanship? And I guess in asking that, I'll add on to that, to hold on to political philosophies, but acknowledge and actually work together.
I think there is, Stu. I think there's still the chance there, right? We're all still Americans. And I think our biggest barrier to that right this second is that we've allowed our politics to become infected with people who don't care anything about public service, who see it as an opportunity to climb a political ladder, to build a political career for themselves, to build relationships with billion-dollar corporations that are going to pay off monetarily for one individual. But what gets lost when we do that is the fact that people feel like they're not very well represented. And so if we can get back to the idea of public service there and return, you know, demand candidates that are dedicated to public service, hold our politicians accountable if they abandon their public service emphasis, then we're going to end up with folks in our government that are not only dedicated to public service, but that's going to mean they're willing to come together, collaborate, to compromise, to do things together that might not be perfect, but they will be better than what we're getting when everybody's either far right or far left, and that's the only thing that ends up on TV. Because there's plenty of folks like me that are just right here wanting to serve people in the middle and willing to do whatever I can to make it better. I think we just demand better from candidates and politicians, and we end up with a coalition of folks like me who want to set aside partisanship, who want to set aside rhetoric and get things done for people who need it.
Was there a particular moment that you can cite when you said, I'm going to run for Congress?
You know, I don't know if there was one moment. There was this series of moments, Stu. As I saw some of the things happening, as I saw the nastiness, as I saw, you know, the abandonment of what I thought were regular folks who really needed competence and good governance, and the sense that people like me just don't get a chance to speak up. That people who come from where I come from are oftentimes considered secondary or unimportant. And it was just a culmination of thoughts and beliefs that I had of what I was watching, especially at the federal level. And I just thought, man, I think we can do better. I think I can help us do better. And that's what really got me into the race.
How do you feel about term limits?
I am totally on board with term limits. In fact, I can't believe we still elect folks who aren't totally on board with term limits. I understand folks will sometimes run on term limits and then abandon them later. But that's an example of self-service and not public service. This should truly be a service. When I was in the Marine Corps, I served for 4 years. When I was a police officer, I served for 5 years. And plenty of people make those careers. But I see this as something where regular folks should have an opportunity to run for and win seats like this, to go up there and provide perspective, to deliver for the people who need it. And then we should all come back after a relatively short amount of time, right? Four terms at most for a congressman. Come back and live in the community that you helped create, for good or for bad. I think it's the idea that folks can go and stay in Washington, D.C. 30, 40, 50 years that totally disconnects them from the reality, the ground level impact of the legislation they pass. And I think if more folks knew they were coming back to live in that community after 8 years or 12 years or whatever it might be, then they would be much more careful in how they legislate and be much more attuned to the ground level effects of what their legislation is going to do. Because if they can insulate themselves with a 50-year political career, why would they care what the impact is here in your community?
So there's I think it's fair to say, a masking debate across this country, to wear a mask, not wear a mask. Has that surprised you?
It has surprised me. It has surprised me because, you know, CDC guidelines, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Stack here in Kentucky is telling us all every single day, epidemiologists from all across the country, all across the world are saying, hey, a mask can be just as effective as a vaccine. And you don't have to wear it all the time. You don't have to wear it to sleep in. You don't have to wear it in the truck when you're by yourself. But if you're going in the grocery store, put on your mask like you would put on your shirt. Put on your mask like you would put on a pair of shoes and spend 15 minutes in there with it on and then come out and take it off. That keeps people safe. It's just become so polarized, so politicized in this country that that's the shame of it, that this is not a political calculation. This is a public health consideration. And we don't wear masks to keep ourselves safe. We wear masks to keep other people safe. And so we just have to end the selfishness that folks feel, the politicization of this issue, and just say, look, you know, I've got immunocompromised folks in my family that are at risk if folks won't wear a mask. And so it's not a burden to me. I put it on because I want to keep my family safe. I put it on because I want to keep your families safe, Stu. And I think more folks just need to end the political partisanship and just take a look at what the public health cost is going to be if we don't think of someone other than ourselves for a moment.
All right. I'd like to end with on a light note, I guess I'll call it. Do you have a favorite song or band?
You know, I'm very, very attuned to Kentucky artists. And so I have my very favorite bluegrass band is two ladies from here in central Kentucky. They're called the Local Honeys. They're wonderful. I'm a big fan of Tyler Childers, Sturgill Simpson, big fan of Kentucky artists. Ian Noe, who lots of people might not know about, but they should because he's wonderful. I try to focus on Kentucky artists. They sing songs that really speak to me. And from country to bluegrass, that's kind of what I listen to when I'm in the truck.